This is WFAE Talks. I'm Greg Collard. With me, as always, is education reporter Lisa Miller. Hello, Lisa.
Hey, Greg.
You've been busy this week. You had a trip to Raleigh.
I did have a trip to Raleigh. So I usually listen to all these State Board of Education meetings and joint legislative meetings online. But I went up there this week, and it was definitely more fun to see the dynamics in the room than imagining it.
Were the instincts of your boss correct in saying you really should go to Raleigh for this?
Yes.
I'm glad to hear that. Usually we have Ben Bradford with us, our energy environment reporter. He's not here today. He's sleeping, I take it, because he has had a busy week, and he spent all day Wednesday up north at the Dan River covering the Duke Energy coal ash spill. He filed a story early this morning. We'll get into that. But in his place is – what's your name? Oh, in his place is Tom Bullock. He's our new reporter, Tom Bullock. He started this week. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Tell our listeners a little about yourself.
I've had a busy week too, but it's mostly been unpacking. I just came from NPR Network, where I was there for 15 years. I started off as an intern, but also served on 5 years on the foreign desk, where I got a report from pretty much all over the world. Was the senior producer for the election unit in 2008. And my wife and I just finally decided let's go someplace where we want to lay down roots, and Charlotte was our pick. So here I am.
You've spent a lot of time covering how long did you spend in Iraq?
The better part of 4.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and on my time off, I got to go to wonderful places like Afghanistan and Yemen. So they definitely let me see the glory parts of the world. It was more fun than it sounds, I promise.
Good. We'll take your word for it. So what's your impressions of Charlotte so far? Would tell us a little.
I love it. And it's a really fascinating place. And just so the listeners know, my beat is going to be money and influence. And actually, it's a really great state to be in for that, because we obviously have an election coming up. And pretty much everybody I talked to in D.C. when I told them that I was coming down to Charlotte, they all seemed incredibly excited, because it's looking like North Carolina is going to be a major hotbed for political issues for 2014, for 2016. It's a really dynamic state and a really interesting place to be, specifically the Charlotte area.
All right. Well, let's move on to the show. Usually we talk about three issues. This week is no exception. Today, this week's topics: the coal ash spill, the third grade reading law, and the high stakes in this year's North Carolina Supreme Court election. That's something Tom's been looking into already. First, the biggest story of the week. Here's an excerpt from Ben Bradford's story when he talks to Jenny Edwards of the Dan River Basin Association as she was scooping water from the bottom of the river about a mile from the coal ash leak.
So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to take this little pitcher and rinse it out. So you can see that the natural bed of the river is right here, and you can clearly see the demarcation. So that's coal ash all right there.
Yeah. The brown mud that's ever present along the river sinks to the bottom of the pitcher, while a fine black slurry specked with silver separates
to
the top.
Yeah, that's coal ash. What impact is that going to have on fish and wildlife?
What impact remains to be seen, although it's obviously not a pretty scene right now. This kind of stuff, I think, is scary in a number of ways. What impact does this have right now in the Dan River, but also the potential for this kind of thing happening elsewhere? These ponds are located throughout the state, and they've been a source of controversy for a long time.
They are. I think there are about 14 of them throughout the state. And here to the Charlotte area, the closest one is Mountain Island Lake, next to Mountain Island Lake, which is, of course, where we get our drinking water in Charlotte. There are lawsuits right now and settlements going on as far as how that is regulated.
Now, we should point out the ones that are near Charlotte, and I think just about all of the others in the state, are built a little bit differently. This one where the leak occurred actually has a drainage pipe running underneath the 27-acre pond. It's hard to believe a 27-acre qualifies a pond. I don't know what that what's the differences between a pond and a lake, where that line is. But anyway, that pipe ruptured, and the water and the coal ash that's in it went through that pipe and is draining out in the Dan River. So it is a little bit different situation. But one of the big concerns here has been seepage of these ponds going into Mountain Island Lake.
Well, I think this is one of those classic situations where the fear is the unknown. What we really don't know yet is whether or not the long-term effects of coal ash in a river like the Dan River, what kind of an effect they're going to have, not only on the drinking water, let's say, of Danville, which is, of course, the closest large city that gets its drinking water from the Dan River, but also let's talk about wildlife. I mean, what are the long-term effects for fish who may be, you know, swimming and eating, obviously? Whether they're, you know, imagine a bass going up to get a bug, and suddenly with that bug, it gets a mouthful of ash. You get concentrations in fish. I mean, it's one of the things that we've all learned about when it comes to, say, mercury with tuna. And I don't want to equate the two, but we really have to wait and see. And I think
the overall, the overall food chain. A lot of lay your eggs on the bottom. The fish lay their eggs on the bottom, but also just crayfish, all kinds of critters that they depend on. They eat.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the reasons we'll have to stay on the story for a while, because as we really don't know what we don't know yet. I mean, so far, we've had one set of test results come back, but it's from Duke Energy. There are at least three other groups that I've heard that are doing test results. I'm very curious to see what happens with those. There's certainly some potentially nasty things in coal ash. I mean, when you hear, you know, selenium, arsenic, these are not things that you necessarily want in the food supply, but we just don't know yet what kind of concentrations you're going to find.
And what happens when that dust is – it's settled right now, or it's settling, but – what happens when it gets stirred up again, whether it's high water, big flood coming through and it spreads all throughout again, or people going along the bottom and it gets stirred up, things happen and this thing will get stirred. This stuff will get stirred up again.
Absolutely.
And Tom, you were saying before when we were talking that, you know, coal ash is kind of different consistencies wherever you go.
Yeah, I mean,
different ingredients.
That's exactly right. I mean, my home state is Utah. And obviously, it's big coal mining country out there. And one thing that I learned from a friend of mine who's actually in the coal industry is that coal is very different. It's very specific. You know, coal from out west is different than Appalachian coal, has different things in it as it's formed. And so you can even find different concentrations of different minerals and elements from mine to mine and even mine shaft to mine shaft. So there's still a lot that we just don't know yet that we have to figure out. But potentially, I mean, this is the kind of thing you want to keep an eye on for quite some time.
Moving on to the next subject, the third grade reading law known as Read to Achieve. I'm not sure if everyone would give it that very nice sounding name. I think other people have names for it.
I think that's thrown a lot of people as far as what that law is.
Well, this is the new law, of course, where all third graders are required to read at a third grade level, and if not, the idea behind it is to end the concept of social promotion. If you don't meet the third grade reading requirements, then you have to go to these reading camps, and if you don't pass the reading requirements in the reading after going through the reading camps, you have to go to fourth grade and have this third grade retention level. But how you determine whether kids are meeting the third grade reading requirements is really causing a lot of anxiety in schools. And you saw a lot of that yesterday in Raleigh.
I did. I mean, it is a very complicated law. And there are multiple ways that schools can figure out if a student is reading at grade level. So basically, they can, you know, take the end of year tests. And if they're reading at grade level, then that's great. They can go on to fourth grade, don't have to go to summer camp and all that. But there's also another way to do it, which is, you know, for example, the state lawmakers say they designed it this way because, you know, if there's a kid who freaks out with testing, that instead of having this one sort of big end of year test, they can take all these sort of really much smaller tests over several months, but there are 36 of these tests and they're maybe 15 minutes long. And when you think of each kid going through that, that is a lot of time. And, you know, basically districts, how they're treating this is they're putting a lot of kids who at the beginning of the year tested that they were struggling readers. They're just saying, hey, let's go ahead. We want to give you every chance you can get to, you know, pass this test so you don't have to go to the summer reading camp and all that. So, you know, let's just for, you know, the ease of our minds, let's have you go through these tests.
It's taken away a lot of instruction time.
It is. And district superintendents, they are saying they hate this. Teachers have said the same thing. parents. You're starting to hear some of the frustration happening now. But it is, I mean, it is contentious. And at the state board meeting yesterday, Mark Edwards, he's the Mooresville Graded School Superintendent. He's a advisor to the board. I mean, you could hear the level of exasperation in his voice.
When the student is told that you're going to have to pass 36 reading passages in the next few months, and I'm going to start sending it. I think maybe we ought to have a consortium, all the parents in the state who are saying, not only will my child hate reading, my child is beginning to hate school. And they're throwing up in the morning because they're told, if you don't pass this today, you'll be going to summer camp. And the outrage of parents all over this whole state, and we were using a measure that was not valid and reliable. And we talked about the process. It didn't meet the standard. We went ahead and sent it out. That's the superintendents haven't gotten outraged over this because it's fun to do. We've got outraged over it because of what's happening to students and teachers. And the morale of third grade teachers today, do a test on morale. I guarantee you that it has never been lower. Never been lower. And the idea, the overreach of we're going to tell you by the minute what to do every day. We're going to test students to the point that they're nauseated when you mention reading. We're going to tell teachers that that the level of pressure on you, not by a summative, every single day. And I have to tell you, it is beyond the pale that we're putting our students and teachers through this process.
Did it have an effect? I mean, did it make people think twice about this, or what? Or were they bothered by what he said?
I think a lot of board members, they're talking to the areas they represent. And, you know, I talked to one of the Union County board members and she said, oh, yeah, this is a big problem. You know, we want to figure out a way around this. So what districts have been asking is to basically, you know, there are tests throughout the year that kind of track kids, progress on things. And they say, we already use these tests. Can this be another measure of whether a kid is reading at grade level and then, you know, has to go into summer camp or goes on to fourth grade? And they say, hey, if we provide this way of doing it, then, you know, we'll have less pressure to run all these kids through this like series of tests. And so the state board today, they made the decision that, yep, that makes sense. There's some, it's not necessarily, they have to do a little bit more studying, but basically it sounds like districts will get this leeway. So it'll be interesting to see if that actually does reduce the number of these, they call them reading portfolio tests, kids are going through or not. But I mean, there is a lot of angst about this. And, you know, you hear superintendents saying, hey, the idea of this law is great, but just the way it's being rolled out, it's having problems. And, you know, it sounds like even state lawmakers are saying the same, you know, people who voted for it.
Any indication that they are going to be making major changes, maybe even revoking it or anything as it reached that level?
I have not talked to a lot of this bill was Senator Berger's bill. I've not talked to him myself. I've talked to, June Atkinson, the state superintendent, the Mooresville superintendent, who has talked to him. And, you know, it seems like he's saying, hey, we didn't want it to be this big of a headache. You know, we're willing to get on board. But the thing is, the state legislature meets in May. So, I mean, this is going to be kind of going through the system well before they can tweak it. They can tweak the summer reading camps in time for the summer as far as how long they go.
Do they know where they're going to be? I mean, they're not going to be at every school, are they? Or are they going to be at some central location?
It is very up in the air. No, I mean, most of the day, they probably won't be at every school. But, you know, you got to have more than one central location for these summer reading camps because you have to provide transportation. And, you know, that just gets really expensive if it's just one central location. And then when you think that, you know, it looks like half the way things are testing out now, half of third graders might have to be going to these summer reading camps. There's no way you could do that all in one place. So there's a lot of unknowns and districts are all kind of working through this right now.
Well, one question I have. And partly both as a journalist and as a parent, to disclosure, I've said this before, as a third grader, is how effective are all these tests, if you're taking them all the time? I mean, I'm going back to school. Tests used to be a really big deal because they didn't come around all that often. But when you're testing all the time, I wonder if your frame of mind is it a big deal? Or maybe that's good that it's not a big deal, but are you taking it as seriously as you should? Or are you treating it like a regular homework assignment where you're maybe not quite 100% on your game and have as much – little anxiety is good sometimes for tests is what I'm saying.
Well, you know, there's a bunch of new tests that the state has added this year to measure – teacher performance, basically, to figure out how much students have grown under a teacher through the course of a year, because they started all these new tests and they said, hey, you know, kids, you got to have a reason to an incentive to do well on this test. So they actually started making it 20% of their grade. So some of these tests do matter. But, you also hear people who are more proponents of the testing and accountability, they would say. And they'd say, you know, a lot of these tests are just like quizzes, like a 15-minute reading test. Well, that should be like a quiz.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, absolutely.
yeah, take questions.
Good. Well, I full disclosure, I'm also a parent. Luckily, my daughter is just 2.5, so I've got time for this the whole thing to shake out. But I'm wondering, are you hearing from teachers? Just, it sounds like this would take up so much time that it almost begs the question of if they only have time to teach to the tests.
Yeah, I mean, the CMS superintendent was saying, hey, when you factor this out as far as all these reading portfolio tests, that's about a third of the time they are doing these things. They're testing kids, you know, a third of the time that could be used for instruction. So yesterday at the State Board of Education meeting, I mean, you were hearing that from board members who had those same concerns.
Well, on to subject number 3. Tom, you're up.
I'm up.
The high stakes in this year's North Carolina Supreme Court election. 4 seats are up for grabs. That's a majority of the Supreme Court.
4 of 7 seats. And actually, I'll have a story out on this next week. It's really fascinating. I mean, besides the fact that you really have the balance of the state's highest court, you know, up for election, you also, if everybody remembers, and I'm sure for anyone who was around here in 2012, you saw one ad that probably defines to you what a seat for an election, rather, for the Supreme Court looks like. And it had a lot of banjo music behind it and some kind of Keystone Criminals. And that ad, I'm willing to bet that our listeners saw, because it ran some 1,600 times throughout the state. And this, of course, was an ad for Judge Paul Newby as he was going up against Judge Sam Ervin.
There's a judge they call Paul Newby. He's got criminals on the run. Paul Steely Stairs got them running scared, and he'll take them down one by one. Paul Newby, he's a tough old judge, respected everywhere. Paul Newby, justice tough but fair. Paul Newby, criminals best beware.
And the reason I bring up that ad and that race in particular is, first of all, 2012 was a more representative kind of year where you had one seat up for election. Mm-hmm. This time we're going to have 4. But that race in particular was the second most expensive judicial race in America that year. Over roughly $4 million were spent. The vast majority of that was actually given by outside groups, the so-called dark money. Mm-hmm. And it very much tended to go more towards Judge Newby than it did towards Judge Ervin. In fact, that ad that I brought up, the banjo ad, it's estimated that ad plus all of the airtime, buying all the airtime, cost about $2 million.
And these outside groups are?
These outside groups are. We don't know exactly yet. That's why they call it dark money. But I'm sure listeners have heard of groups like 501c3s, Citizens United case. These are groups that now, because of decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court, can put large sums of potentially very difficult, if not untraceable, money into elections. And they can run it either in conjunction or basically on their own with the candidates. And these groups could be just about anybody. I mean, if you get a group together, enough of your friends, let's say, and you raise enough money to put a radio ad up or a television ad, you can run that issue ad now. The key thing is the vast majority of this money is coming from outside of the state of North Carolina. And these tend to be politically minded groups that either go conservative or liberal, and they tend to have kind of an agenda. And of course, judges and their election are supposed to be nonpartisan, but you can still have these partisan groups ponying up huge amounts of cash. And if you think about it, I mean, if you think like a businessman, let's say, swaying the Supreme Court may be a more effective use of your money than, let's say, trying to elect people that you think will be aligned with your interests in state legislature or even the governor, because you only have to go with 4 of 7 seats instead of, you know, the governorship, which is only one. That's incredibly expensive. And obviously there's a lot more legislators than 7.
And then candidates can't really address where they stand on cases or cases that are pending, or they don't have to really say a whole lot about what's going to appear before them, before the court, correct?
That's correct. And they also, by state law, are not supposed to identify by party. Mm-hmm. So
make some interesting ads.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. You distinguish yourself in creative ways. As
I think Newbies was, you know, he'll lock the criminals up.
Yeah, exactly, which you would expect of a judge. But it's
Well, not of a Supreme Court judge, though. It really just you're interpreting law and saying
that's actually true.
You're
it is an appellate court. Yes. That's true. But I'm very curious to see the ads in the groups, and I'll be tracking exactly as best we can where the money is coming from and how it falls ideologically.
Tom, thanks for sitting in for Ben.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, Lisa, talk to you again next week. And
sounds good.
Out in the newsroom too, I guess.
Good deal.
All right.